You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And top of the Friday the 13th to you. We'll have a conversation about that as we go through the day. What is the meaning of Friday the 13th? Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and it's the first hour of our Friday program, which means it is time for Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting. I've got him on the right line here, Shane. Today, you're at Senator Sanders, you are at a senatorial retreat on Martha's Vineyard. Should we call this program today Brunch with Bernard? Sorry. I couldn't resist. How's everything going? What are your thoughts on what's in the news today, sir?
Well, my thoughts are that in what is the beginning of a very negative campaign, it's very important that we focus on the real issues and not get caught up in media gossip and personalities. Mm. And that the American people understand the stakes for which we are fighting. And I guess my view at the end of the day is I understand that there is a lot of disappointment at President Obama's record, and I share that disappointment. But not for one second should we minimize what it would mean to this country if Mitt Romney were president and if the Republicans continued to control the House and they gained control of the Senate. And what that would mean is a right-wing attack, which would be unprecedented in the modern history of America, because we're not just talking about folks who want to cut back on programs for the middle class and working families, Tom. What we're talking about are right-wing extremists who really want to create in this country an oligarchic form of government and essentially end many of the programs that working families have fought for the last 80 years. Certainly Social Security is on that list. Medicare, as we know it, major cuts in Medicaid, major cuts in federal aid to education, and on those who want to abolish the federal government's role in higher education. Certainly they want to eviscerate the Environmental Protection Agency, allow the polluters to do what they want to do. More tax breaks for the very wealthiest people in this country at the same time as they're cutting back programs that the middle class depends upon. So the stakes in this election are enormously high. And what we have got to focus on is what a progressive agenda means, and we have to continue the fight for a progressive agenda. We have to never forget that right now, as we talk, you have some 24 million Americans who are either unemployed or underemployed, families who are really, really hurting. Media doesn't cover this every single day, but you know, as a United States Senator from Vermont, I talk to people in my state, talk to people around the country, old people, I shouldn't say old people, people in their 50s, 55, hope to work to 65, they've lost their job, may never work again, young people who are having a very difficult time finding jobs while they're asked to pay very, very high college loans, kids who would like to get away from their families still being forced to live at home. Families out there who want to send their kids desperately to college can't afford to do that. So there's a lot of hurt. There's a lot of pain in this country, and we've got to be very systematic and figure out where do we go from here? What makes sense? And I think as we have discussed on this show, and as many of you call us, almost every week people call in, we need a massive federal jobs program. We need to start creating the millions of jobs that the American people need. And God only knows there is more than enough work to be done. Mm. Now, I'm happy to report that a couple of weeks ago, finally, a modest transportation bill was passed. We had passed a bipartisan bill in the Senate months ago. It took the House forever to do anything, and a modest bill was passed, which will mean millions of jobs will be saved and created. But we have got to go a lot further than that. Anybody in any state in this country understands that our roads, our bridges, our water systems, our wastewater plants, our airports, our public transportation, our rail system need an enormous amount of work. And when you do that work, you make America more competitive and you create millions of jobs. So we have got to do that. Put people back to work rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. In terms of energy, huge issue. We've got to break our dependence on foreign oil. We have to move to energy efficiency. I come from a cold weather state. There are people who are spending 20, 30, 40% more for fuel than they should be spending because their homes are poorly insulated. This is true all over America, and it's true in those areas where it's 100 degrees today and they're losing energy from their air conditioner because their homes are not efficient. To weatherize our homes will create a significant number of jobs. To move to wind, solar, geothermal, biomass is huge. Tom, you may have seen, I don't know if you've discussed it yet on your show, this business of the U.S. Olympic Committee.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Have we talked about it?
Buying uniforms, Ralph Lauren uniforms made in China.
Yeah.
And this is just a symbol of the disastrous state of a trade in America. The fact that people could give 1 second, this is the pride and joy of American athletics. These are the best athletes we have. They're representing the United States of America. And they're going to London in clothes made in China because presumably in the midst of a recession, there's just no companies in America that are able to make these uniforms. And of course, that's, you know, I don't believe that for a second.
Yeah. It's like the other half of that irony is that this story came out several months ago. The border guards down on the Mexican border, the U.S. border guards, their uniforms are made in Mexico.
No, that I knew. And that's an issue, by the way, that we're working on. Over the last couple of years, I've been working, as we've discussed on the show, with the Smithsonian gift shops.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
To get them to purchase more products made in the United States. They're doing that. We're working with the companies that sell products, gifts at the National Monuments, making some progress on that. We're also working with the Veterans Administration, who in their own gift shops were selling too many products made from abroad. But bottom line here, if the middle class is going to survive in America, not only do we need to create millions of decent-paying jobs, rebuilding our infrastructure, dealing with our energy system, we need to deal with trade. And that has NAFTA, that has permanent normal relations with China, and that is to save these huge multinational corporations. You have to invest here in America. You want us every night on television. You're telling us how much you want us to buy your products. We'll start building those products here in America. And last but not least, when we talk about job creation, it is insane in a competitive global economy that we are laying off teachers, that we're laying off child care workers, that we're laying off cops and firemen. And we need to have the best educated workforce in the world. You don't do that by laying off teachers and child care workers and college professors. So I think, you know, there's a program out there that we can fight for to create jobs, to rebuild the middle class. And as I've mentioned also on the show in the past, as the months, as this campaign proceeds and after the campaign, the major issue out there will be how to deal with deficit reduction. And I want all of the listeners never to forget how we got into this deficit in the first place. That's not something our Republican friends are talking about. And that means we went into two wars, and George Bush and his friends just forgot to pay for those wars. So worried were they about the deficit that they had no problem spending what will amount to trillions of dollars on war without putting a nickel into it. And not only that, in an unprecedented way, while you went to war, they also decided to give massive tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country. And then on top of that, because of the greed and the illegal behavior that took place on Wall Street, which drove us into the recession we're in, revenue now, as a percent of GDP, is the lowest that it has been in over 50 years. So we're getting less revenue coming in. We spent more money on the wars. We gave huge tax breaks, and we're in a deficit. And then our Republican friends say, oh, my goodness, we're in this terrible deficit. We have got to cut Social Security. We've got to cut Medicare, Medicaid, education, environmental protection. That's the only way out. Well, some of us say, no, that is not what we're going to do. We're going to ask the wealthiest people in this country, the largest corporations, to stop paying their fair share of taxes, among other things.
It is our brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls in our national town hall meeting up next.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Brunch with Bernie, sanders.senate.gov is website. Up next, 866-987-THOM, your calls for Senator Sanders.
In our personal ambition, we are individualists. But in our seeking for economic and political progress as a nation, we all go up, or else we all go down as one people.
You say we all go up or we all go down as one people? That's great. Thank you, Shane. Welcome back. It's our Brunch with Bernie. Our Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls. And Bernie, all set to go?
Let's do it.
Okay, Larry in Winchester, Kentucky. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hey, how you guys doing? How you doing, Senator?
Good.
Senator, I was wondering. I kind of tend to leaning towards libertarianism.
Mm-hmm.
Libertarianism, you know, individual responsibility. Liberties, you know, up to a certain, of course, within the law, of course. Don't you agree also that there are too many federal regulations in this country that are destroying businesses? I had two businesses of my own, and they both got destroyed in 2008. I would like for another comment. On your thoughts of the no-prime loan situation, where the Democrats pushed all the banks to give loans to people that could not afford the loans. Like I said, I was in real estate up north in Chicago, and I saw it going on. I couldn't believe my eyes. But let's give an example. A Mexican woman bought an $800,000 house. She was a bus driver. She couldn't make the payments, so she couldn't figure out why.
And who lent her the money?
I'm sorry.
Larry, who lent her that money?
The banks. The banks were forced by the Democrats.
Larry.
Hold on.
You've asked some good questions. Let me just respond. I think I don't know, obviously, what happened to your business, but 2008 was a very, very bad year. And to sit around and say, well, it was the Democrats' fault for the financial crisis, which led to the recession, I think would not be quite adequate. There is enough blame to go around, but I think the lion's share of the blame has to be placed on the people who fought very hard for the deregulation of Wall Street, who took advantage of deregulation, and who then acted in illegal and improper ways. That is the largest banks in this country. Now, I know it's convenient for conservatives then to blaming Obama or blaming Democrats for everything in the world, but you talked about personal responsibility. Let's talk about responsibility. If you are Wall Street and you spend billions of dollars over a 10-year period to get deregulated, and then when you get deregulated, you bring about these huge mergers, you start creating the most complicated financial transactions in human history. You lead the world to the edge of a financial abyss and an international depression. You know, maybe Wall Street should take some financial responsibility. Maybe they should apologize to the American people for being dishonest, for acting illegally, for being reckless, for being greedy, for being irresponsible. And it's just too easy to say, well, it's the Democrats' fault. No, the Democrats have their share of the blame for participating in deregulation, which was led by the Republicans, but Democrats were there too. So in terms of, you know, overregulation, sure, there are too many regulations. But the problem with this country right now is that you have an economic level of concentration of ownership that is, I think, very, very frightening. And as I've mentioned before, we talked a moment ago about agriculture, and David from Missouri was talking about the power of big agriculture. And that is, compared to Wall Street, relatively, to use a pun, small potatoes. Because what you have on Wall Street right now, and I want you to hear this, Larry, you got six financial institutions who have assets equivalent to two-thirds of the GDP of the United States of America, over $9 trillion. They write half the mortgages, produce two-thirds of the credit cards in America. That's power. That's wealth. And these guys have abused that power. They have abused that wealth. And in my view, they are the people responsible for the recession, which has caused so much pain in this country today. So, you know, I think it's not quite fair. You want to blame Democrats, fine, blame Democrats, blame Republicans. But ultimately, I think the source of this problem, this crisis, the financial crisis, is the financial institutions. And I believe we're working, Larry, I would tell you, on a number of issues trying to some degree, alleviate the situation. Right now, we're trying to work on the Fed to say that it is absurd that people like Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, are sitting on the New York Fed. This is the fox guarding the henhouse. So we're trying to bring about Fed reform. More importantly, I believe, that the time is now to break up these huge financial institutions. Too much wealth, too much power. They're leading us down the path once again, in my view, to a too big to fail bailout. But even if that doesn't happen, their power is just too great. So, Larry, I would take a hard look at Wall Street if you want to really understand what's going on economically in America.
Trevor in Phoenix, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Thanks, Bernie. What is the health care package for a member of Congress entailed? Is it like Medicare, and do you get to keep it after your term? And I'll take my answer off there.
Thanks. I get those people who are eligible for Medicare, get Medicare. They pay for Medicare. Basically, what members of Congress have, and I think there's a lot of misinformation that goes around the website, we have the same, I have the same package benefits that, my secretary has, people in my office have, any federal employee has. You got a whole long laundry list of different insurance companies and different programs that you can choose from. My family does Blue Cross Blue Shield, and we pay into it A federal government is a good employer in that sense, but the benefits that we get are the same as any federal employee.
So it's not some cushy thing that members of Congress.
The federal
have.
Government is a good employer in that sense for Congress and for other people as well who work for the federal government.
Yeah, we just have a couple seconds before the break. How do we get more businesses in America to be like that, to offer that kind of insurance?
Well, that's a good question, but I think the more important question is how we move to a national health care program.
There you go.
Which guarantees health care to all.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Right to the point. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back with more of your calls in our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders. Brunch with Bernie.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with more with Senator Sanders in just a moment. And check out TomHartman.com, too. By the way, we've got a brand new update to our iPhone and iPad app. It's free. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. And, Senator, you're here?
I'm right here.
Great. Okay, Jack in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, greetings, Senator Sanders. Hi, Tom. Not too long ago, I heard of a movement that was coming into being to recharter U.S. corporations, and that there was talk of even turning it into a constitutional amendment. And the idea was to change them from their current mandate of only returning profit to making them corporate citizens, with corporate stewards and assuming some environmental and social responsibility. I wondered if you knew if this movement was still going on and what happened to it. It sort of dropped out.
Jack,
of my...
I apologize. I really don't know much about that. All that I do know, and the issue obviously that I am focused on, is the Supreme Court Citizens United decision, their absurd decision, claiming that corporations are people and giving them constitutional rights to spend as much money as they want in elections. I should mention, Jack, in that regard, that next week there will be a bill on the floor. I think the first vote is Monday night, called the Disclose Act. And it's a very simple bill. It doesn't go anywhere near as far as it has to go, but it's a start. And what it says that for corporations that are spending more than, I believe, $10,000 on campaign expenditures, putting on TV ads, radio ads, et cetera, that they have to disclose, they have to list who is paying for those ads. Not a very radical act, I should think. But my understanding is Republicans will be opposing even that. And I hope everybody understands the impact that Citizens United is having on American politics. And that is that we're looking at large corporate entities, whether it's the Koch brothers, whether it's Mr. Adelson, and others who are prepared to spend hundreds of millions of dollars in order to elect candidates who are sympathetic to the wealthy and the powerful and defeat those candidates who are fighting for working families. This is one of the most severe and outrageous attacks on American democracy that we have ever seen. And that is why I and some other members in the Senate have constitutional amendments in that would overturn Citizens United. But the Disclose Act is a step forward to say at least the public has a right to know who is spending this huge amount of money on campaigns.
Tony, in Stafford, Virginia, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I got a call about the unemployment rate. Hello?
Yeah.
Last month they were really excited about if the unemployment would be higher, the unemployment rate would have gone down by a higher numbers of people finding jobs and all that. But then it was adjusted for the public sector employees being laid off, which made it a real disappointing figure.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, are the governors of certain states purposely laying off workers to keep the unemployment rate artificially high?
I don't know the answer to that, Tony. What I do know is you certainly have governors out there who do not believe in public, that the government should be providing public services to people and are going about the business of dealing with their deficits in very regressive ways, which include laying off teachers, firemen, police officers, which obviously increase the unemployment rate. But Tony, the only other point that I would add to that is you should understand that how we calculate national unemployment rates, there are different types of indices used. And when you see a number of 8.2%, which is, I think, now the quote-unquote official unemployment rate, that is not really the true unemployment rate in America, because that does not include those people who have given up looking for work, and it does not include those people who are working part-time when they want to work full-time. When you add all of that together, unemployment is a heck of a lot higher, unfortunately, than 8.2%.
Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, it's time to reach across the aisle again. Cooperate with the Republicans and help them downsize government. Let's start with the House of Representatives. Let's redefine the House of Representatives as one representative for every 10 million people and lay off 350 of them and send them home to go get a real job.
Sad, do you think that's going to solve the nation's problems?
They don't do anything anyway. I think they can do nothing with 70 members of the House as well as they can do nothing with 435.
Well, my own view, Ed, is not quite that. My thought is that government should do something, and the problem is not the size of the House of Representatives or the size of the Senate. The real problem is the degree to which members of the House and the Senate end up protecting the wealthiest people in this country rather than working families. And if you send them home, that ain't going to make the situation any better. What it in fact will do is give the big money interest even more power. So if you really want to make government responsive to the needs of people, Ed, I think we got to overturn Citizens United, which makes a bad situation worse. I think you have to move to public funding of elections. I think you have to reinvigorate the American public to get involved in politics, to hold their elected officials accountable. We need a progressive agenda out there. But I think term limits or cutting the size of the House of Representatives is not going to in any significant way or serious way address the major problems facing our country.
Mark in Columbus, Ohio, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, it's a pleasure to talk to a true patriot like yourself.
Thank you, Mark.
You were talking about the deficit and the unfunded wars, and I have heard some discussion about requiring the president, before he took us into a war, to pay for that, whether it be by a tax surcharge or some other mechanism. What is this, A, feasible, and B, what would it require, a constitutional amendment, or?
Well, I mean, Ed, Mark, the truth is that that's how we have funded wars in the past. War is an expensive proposition. It's not a free ride. And it is wrong to simply add it to the credit card and let our kids pay for it. If a president decides to suggest that we go to war, ask Congress to go to war, he's going to have to figure out a way to pay for it. And historically, that has been the case. What Bush did is not only choose not to pay for the war, at the same exact time, during the war, he gave huge tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country, unprecedented, and certainly adding to our national debt and to our deficit. So bottom line is, clearly, if you're going to go to war and you're just going to spend trillions of dollars, you can't just pass that bill on to the kids. You've got to figure out a way to pay for it. And let the American people decide, by the way, if that's something they do want to pay for.
James, in Arkadelphia, Arkansas, do I have that right, James?
Yeah, kind of like Philadelphia, but with an arc.
Okay.
Yes, I have. I wanted to tell you something about Medicaid. I can tell you a lot about Medicaid because I've been on it for over 20 years from a car accident I had. And, it's been weakened really bad since Governor Mike Huckabee, the Republican, got a hold of it. I'm very happy to have it. But I have an idea. You know, the states that are thinking about opting out, like Texas, of Medicaid, why don't you give that money to the states that want to opt in, like us?
Well, that's an interesting question, James. I know the state of Vermont wants to see all of our people covered. Many of us believe that health care is a right, and we applaud the effort of the federal government to expand Medicaid coverage to 30 million new Americans, additional Americans. And James is suggesting that there are those states who do not want to see their uninsured covered, despite the fact that for the first 3 years, the federal government is going to pay 100% of the cost. And he is suggesting that maybe we give that money to states who do want to see their uninsured covered. Well, that's an interesting idea, James. We'll keep that under advisement.
Jerry in Louisville, Kentucky. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello.
Hi. You are on the air, Jerry.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Sanders, I would like to tell you that I wish there were more people like you in Washington today, that we need, the average person needs people like you.
Thank you very much.
And I admire you very much. I have a two-part question, and then I will say my questions and then let you answer my questions if you don't mind. I saw President Bush at one time just in a small interview, TV interview, and just was so excited about the jobs that were leaving the country, the companies that were leaving to go over to other companies, countries. How many of the companies, if you know, left the United States to move to China or someplace else while the Bush administration was there?
Jerry, I don't have the figures right in front of me, but I will tell you, I don't think there's any dispute that virtually every single major corporation in America, from General Electric on down, engaged very significantly in outsourcing. The former head of General Electric, a fellow named Jack Welch, right. He's made the statement, Jerry, and I want you to hear this. What he said is that he wishes he could have done manufacturing on a barge, i.e. taken his plants to those parts of the world where wages were lowest. So to answer that question, virtually every major American corporation has outsourced very significantly.
We'll be back with more of your questions for Senator Bernie Sanders in our Brunch with Bernie National Town Hall meeting right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Check out Bernie's website, Sanders.Senate.gov. You can also drop by our website at TomHartman.com. We've got a new iPhone, iPad app there. It's free.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows. Anything goes
Friday. Well, we'll get to Anything Goes Friday in the next hour. Right now, it's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Steve in Bradford, Vermont. You're on the air with your senator.
Hi, Bernie. This is Steve from Bradford. I'm glad that I can vote for you. I have one question for you. If corporations are people, and if I'm a people, why can't I be a corporation?
Congratulations, Steve Incorporated. You're now a corporation. No, that... You know, Steve, that Citizens United decision is, if it weren't so painful and if it wasn't having such a horrendous impact on our democracy today, it really would be laughable that five members of the Supreme Court can decide that a corporation is a person. So it's a huge issue out there. As I mentioned earlier, on Monday night, I believe There'll be a bill on the floor beginning to start to take this apart by demanding the corporations that are spending large sums of money on campaigns have to disclose who they are and where that money is going. So it's a start, but we've got a long way to go. But thanks for the question, Steve.
Mike, in Big Creek, California, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. My question is, can you pass a law or propose a law to cap the tax cuts at a quarter of a million so that everybody gets a break, but it stops at a quarter million?
Yeah, that's what the president is talking about. But the president, as I understand your question, Mike, what will be coming before the Senate and what the president is pushing is a repeal of Bush's tax breaks for the wealthy, for people who are earning more than $250,000 a year. And I think that makes sense. And I think for those people who are serious, my Republican colleagues who talk about the deficit, the impact it has on this country, and at the same time, I want to continue huge tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country, especially at a time when we are having growing income and wealth inequality in America. I think they're being hypocritical. So the answer is yes. I think legislation of that sort will be coming. Will it pass the U.S. House of Representatives, which is controlled by right-wing Republicans whose function in life is to protect the wealthy? I doubt it very much. Will we get 50 votes in the Senate? I suspect we will. My guess is we'll probably need 60 because the Republicans will filibuster it.
Mick, is it Mick or Mike in Toledo, Ohio?
Yeah, it's Mick.
Mick, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
It's great to talk to you guys. Senator, I'd like to ask you, why do you think that President Obama, he doesn't come across more forcefully when he should bring up these things like $2 trillion for the wars that Bush never put on the books and he did? And, you know, and that added to the deficit and all this deregulation that they did, and they're stonewalling him and everything. I mean, I hear him talk about it, you know, a little bit, but I don't know if you heard Vice President Biden yesterday talking, but, you know, that's the kind of speech I would like to hear from President Obama so that the country will get it, that the Republicans, you know, they want him to fail so they can get the White House back.
Well, Mick, I agree with you. I really do, and I think you'd be surprised that a number of members in the Senate would concur with you. From day one, you know, it's funny, when Ronald Reagan was president, he spent 8 years running against Jimmy Carter. And it worked for him, for better or worse. I think history will record George W. Bush as one of the worst presidents in the history of this country. And he left this country at a moment when we were losing 700,000 jobs a month, when this country was on the verge, not only itself, but the entire world, of a major international depression. That's what Bush left us. And for whatever reason, I think President Obama has been very shy about talking about Bush's record, talking about the hole that he had to begin to fill, the opposition that comes every single day from Republicans, who I can tell you in the Senate have been more obstructionists with more filibusters than any time in certainly the modern history of this country. Has the president been as forceful as he should be in taking on these guys and explaining that reality to the American people? I would agree with Mick. I don't think he has.
Okay. Pat, in Allendale, South Carolina, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes. I'd like to ask the question about global pledge. The fact that these people, we don't know nothing about Grover Pledge. So why
you talking about Grover Norquist?
Pledge to Grover and to the people? Shouldn't they go to jail for that? Because that's two different pledges. Take it off the air.
Tom, was this about Grover Norquist?
Yeah, she was asking why.
Well,
why?
What, yeah. You know, Norquist has done, he's a very good politician, and what he has told Republicans, candidates, is if you want our support, you're going to have to take a pledge that, in essence, you're never going to ask the wealthy to pay more in taxes. You're never going to ask corporations to pay more in taxes. So what you're going to do is your way to balance the budget is to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, and programs that middle-class and lower-income people need, and your job is to protect the wealthy. And many, many Republicans have signed that pledge. I think that is absurd. And I think overwhelmingly the American people understand that when you have the top 1% owning more wealth than the bottom 90%, when you got 400 families in this country owning more wealth than the bottom half of America, that it is time to ask the wealthiest people who are doing phenomenally well in today's economy, whose tax rates are the lowest in decades, to start paying their fair share of taxes. And I think that's what the American people want, and I hope they will make that clear during this election.
Bernie, just 20 seconds here until the end of the hour. Your thoughts for the week?
Well, my thoughts for the week is that the election is heating up. This is an election of enormous consequence. What we need is to work and develop a strong grassroots movement around a progressive agenda which says that government has got to work for all the people and not just those people who, through Citizens United, can contribute hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars into political campaigns. This country belongs to all of us. That's and not just the millionaires and billionaires.
Brilliantly said. Bernie, thank you so much for being with us again this week.
Good to be with you, Tom. Take care.
Have a great weekend. We'll be back with the... I think that I've got... I think that I've figured out LIBOR in a way that maybe nobody else has, and I'd like to roll it around with you after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, here's... I think that I've figured something out about LIBOR, and maybe this... I'm going to throw this out. It's Anything Goes Friday, but I would love to get your feedback on this. Whether you think that, if I've... I'm stumbled across something that nobody else is talking about, or B, if everybody's talking about this and I just completely missed it, or C, actually, most importantly, if you can help me come up with a better metaphor. Let me explain this whole LIBOR thing, because we've got to figure out a way to make this easily understandable to the average American, because this is a big deal. I mean, it's a huge deal. And here's why. The way that LIBOR works is there's this group, the British Banking Association, which is a private trade group, by the way. It's not a government agency. And every day, 16 banks communicate to the British Bankers Association the rate at which they believe they can borrow money overnight. It's the London Interbank Overnight, LIBOR, London Interbank Offered Rate. Okay. And so the 16 of them throw this into the pot. And the Bankers Association randomly pulls 8 out, adds them all together, divides by 8, comes up with the average and says, okay, this is the LIBOR rate. This is the rate that is used to set credit card rates around the world. This is the rate that is used to set mortgage rates around the world. And more importantly, this is the rate that everything that's derived from those are set at. So the derivatives. So if you've got, if you're an investor sitting on $1 billion worth of mortgages, and you've taken that $1 billion of mortgages and you've created a credit default swap or an insurance, basically, that they're not going to default. You bought insurance that they're not going to default to the tune of $1 billion. You got now $2 billion, and then you buy, and then you take that $2 billion and you place bets that they're going to half that they're going to default, half that they're not. Now it's at $10 billion, and then you place bets on those bets, and now it's $100 billion, and then you place bets on those bets, and now you've got $1 trillion, and you literally have $1 trillion. I mean, there's $600 to $900 trillion worth of these kind of bets out there. Credit default swaps, collateralized debt obligations, all these kinds of things that are basically bets on bets on bets that get massively larger with a very, very small underlying piece. So it's like a giant lever, right? It's like holding a baseball out and a little tiny motion where you're holding it will make a big motion at the far end of it as you wave it up and down, right? You just move your wrist a little bit and the whole baseball bat moves. So back before Phil Gramm came in, with Graham Leach Bliley, this piece of legislation in 1999 or 2000 that ended the Glass-Steagall Law. Before that, the banks that set interest rates, the basic banking infrastructure, when interest rates went up or down, it mattered to the banks in a small way, but they couldn't make any big money off this because they couldn't gamble. It was illegal for banks to gamble. Banks had to be banks. They took interest. They took deposits. They wrote mortgages. They loaned money to businesses. They made a run credit cards. But basically, they were banks. That was it. They couldn't create bets. They couldn't invest in the stock market. They couldn't invest. They they couldn't create bets on their own products. They couldn't create these derivatives. The derivatives market also came about as the result of Phil Gramm's efforts with the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, also in 99 or 2000. So before this came along, LIBOR was, it looks like it was probably being gamed for 10 or 20, maybe forever. And it didn't much matter to the rest of the world. But once banks could bet billions, hundreds of billions, trillions, hundreds of trillions of dollars on an overnight basis, you've got a single bank with $100 trillion worth of bets going on out there, and they know that the overnight interest rate is going to go up a hundredth of a point. So they place $100 trillion worth of bets on that hundredth of a point, and they make $10, $20, $30 billion overnight, just like that. You see, the question, this all, I got started thinking about this yesterday. Kevin, one of the guys who works on our TV show, said, you got winners and losers in a marketplace. And if LIBOR is being rigged, what does it matter? Because, some people are going to lose, some people are going to win. Why should we care? Isn't it the people who are gambling in the marketplace who should worry about this? And I'm like, well, it seems to me, and this is where it hit me, today as I was on the train coming into work on the metro, is that the reason that it matters is because the banks now can gamble on their own inside information. So the banks can set the banking banks set the interest rate. That used to be that there was a separate kind of bank. There's these two kinds of banks, commercial banks and investment banks. Commercial banks, and they used to be separate by law. So Goldman Sachs was an investment bank. You couldn't open a checking account with them. You could, give them money to put in the stock market or, things like that. But you couldn't open a checking account with them. And, your local bank, Chattahoochee Bank or whatever it is, they couldn't take your money and put it in the stock market for you. They could only put it in a savings account. But when Phil Gramm and the Republicans in large part, although there were some Democrats on board with this, I don't think people realize what was going on. When Phil Gramm was pushing this stuff because his wife Wendy was on the Enron board of directors, and it was really Ken Lay who was pushing this stuff. They came along and they said, okay, let's let these commercial banks and these investment banks become one entity. And so J.P. Morgan, the investment house, merges with Chase Bank, which used to be a commercial bank, and now you've got J.P. Morgan Chase. Right? You get all these mergers, and suddenly now the banks that are setting the interest rates on which the gambling banks would win or lose are the same thing. So basically what's happening now is that the banks, by setting the LIBOR rate themselves, they are rigging the bet so that they always win, they or their clients. So if you have your money invested with the right bank, it's going to work out well for you. So I'm trying to come up with a metaphor for this, a way to explain this. Would it be like, on one, one group in one circle, you've got just the, you know, you've got the people loaning out the money, right? The in the gambling house, you've got the bank in the casino. And then over here, on the other side, you've got all the people who are gambling. What happens if the bank knows what some of the people gambling, what their odds are going to be, and can communicate that to them so that they can win more frequently? But it's almost like, you know, a casino was to have their own people who knew what the odds are and knew how the things were set up, assuming that they were rigged in a way that was riggable, playing at the tables. I mean, would you go to a casino if you knew that, you know, 10% of the people sitting at the table with you actually worked for the casino and they were there to gamble against you and they had inside information that would allow them to beat you? They knew what the next card was going to be in the deck. Is that the metaphor? Is the metaphor going to the racetrack? I mean, how do you explain this to somebody? How do you simplify this? I'm really, there's got to be a really easy way. If you have a suggestion, give me a call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, of course, anything else. It's Anything Goes Friday, so we can take any topic you want. But if I'm onto something here, I think that this matters big in the post-Phil Gramm world. Oh, it's Friday the 13th. Indeed. I love Friday the 13th. I actually have started a couple of businesses on Friday the 13th intentionally. Signed the papers on Friday the 13th. On the other hand, tomorrow Mercury goes retrograde. So, oop. Anyhow, Al in Las Vegas. Al, did my explanation make any sense? And, I mean, you live in a gambling city. Any thoughts on how we can explain LIBOR to people and why they should be rip-roaring upset about it?
It strikes much too close to my heart.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring in one additional part of the subject you were speaking to. I'm sure you're well aware of the Federal Reserve Bank and how it operates and that it is, you know, a private banking cartel.
Right.
Many people don't realize that 76% of the eight families that own the Federal Reserve Bank are foreign banking cartels. And one of them happened to be Goldman Sachs. And I'm sure you've heard of the under-the-table, no-interest loans that they were giving, the Federal Reserve was giving to Goldman Sachs over the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, not only Goldman Sachs. They've been giving them out to, actually, they were giving them out to corporations. They were giving them to wealthy individuals in the United States. During the last year of the Bush administration, it was, and the, apparently the first year of the Obama, I mean, they may still be doing it. It's absolutely wrong. What's your point, Al?
Well, the point being that, you know, they gave trillions of dollars in loans to the Federal Reserve, gave them to Goldman Sachs, and it was not
just Goldman Sachs. They gave them to General Electric. They gave them to General Motors.
And it just seems to be a conflict of interest, and, you know, it's...
Sure. They gave them to J.P. Morgan Chase. Jamie Dimon sits on the board of the New York Fed, which is part, you know, has you know, representatives at the National Fed. I'm totally with you, Al. It is a conflict of interest, and it is wrong. How do we do that? What do we do about it? I would like to see I'm waiting for Sam on line 7 for Paul to get done with him so I can put him on the air because he's got a LIBOR comment. And thank you, Paul. Sam, hey, Sam.
Exactly when this guy's gonna?
You're on the air.
On the seat and
Sam?
With
no, he's
the
not. Okay,
time.
Sam's not on the air. All right, Sam, you'll have to call back. I'm sorry. Jay in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Yeah, that's too bad about Sam there.
Yeah.
Tom, two really quick things. Anything Goes Friday. I remember your conversation with Tina in the top of the second hour. I think it was a day or two ago. Tanya.
You'll have to refresh my memory about the topic.
Well, you're having a discussion with
her, the conservative that I was debating. Yes, I recall. Yeah.
You kept making the same rational argument, and I always noticed, and I was wondering, do you ever get tired of making these rational arguments with the conservative minds, and does it ever cross your mind that they really aren't interested in rationality? They make irrational arguments, like if you drop taxes on rich people, that somehow poor people are going to make more money.
Right.
when it's proven to be the opposite of what's true.
Food will fall off the tables of the rich people, and then you don't need food stamps.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, assuming that your question is serious, Jay, no, I don't get tired of it, and there's a couple of reasons. One is I spent most of my life debating this kind of stuff with my dad, who you know, lived and died a conservative Republican, more of a Eisenhower Republican than I mean, he's, I don't think he would have had anything to do with today's Republican Party, but I always enjoyed debating politics with him. A and B, the thing that keeps me going on this is the astounding number of people that I've debated over the years who end up becoming progressives. Or, you know, or callers, you know, who say, okay, now I, you know, having heard you have that debate, I know now how to have a conversation with my crazy brother-in-law the next time we get together for Thanksgiving. And I think that it's really important that somebody, and thank you for the call, Jay, and asking the question. I think it's really important that somebody be pushing back on this, somebody be talking back to these folks. And so here I am. Joe in Long Island. Hey, Joe, thanks for listening to WWRL. What's up?
How you doing? I got two questions for you. I think this would solve.
Pick one.
Solve them. Okay.
A lot of callers.
Campaign stuff. Why can't people like me and you pay $100 a year in campaign taxes or whatever you want to call it,
right,
and divide it evenly between whoever's running for president or governor or anything like that?
Yep.
And another thing, I think we have to get rid of the lobbyists.
I think we should. This is what you're talking about, Joe, is publicly funding elections. And if you consider the fact that there are about 120 million Americans who file tax returns, about 120 million people in the workforce, okay, if all of those people put $10 a year in, that's $1.2 billion a year. The presidential elections every 4 years, that's $4.8 billion. Last time we had a presidential election, between the two of them, they spent about, you know, John McCain and Barack Obama, between the two of them, they spent about $1.5 billion. So this would be more than enough to fund the presidential elections. And that's $10, you know, for every taxpayer. I think that we should do it. I absolutely think we do it. We should do it. And I'm with you. Michael in San Diego. Hey, Michael, you got a library suggestion.
Yes, Mr. Hartman. Thank you. Okay, what it is, the way that I know you have a passion for the Iroquois Nation. The Iroquois Nation, from what I believe, they think seven generations ahead.
Yes.
They don't make a decision until seven generations later.
No, all decisions are made in the context of their impact on the seventh generation.
Correct. And so now what we do, we live in a world now where we think one quarter ahead, which is what, only 3 months?
Well, with LIBOR, we think overnight.
And that's even crazier. I agree, man. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point.
That's basically all I wanted to say is that, you know, I think the American Indian is as far as we were supposed to get. You know, we wouldn't have a space shuttle. We wouldn't have cars, but we would be in harmony with the planet. And I think the Iroquois people are a gorgeous people, and it's a shame. But
yeah.
Whatever.
I'm with you, Michael. And Jefferson actually wrote about this at some length. He was very, very impressed by the Native peoples of North America and how they had figured out how to live with each other in peace and with their environment in peace, by and large. And there are lessons that we need to learn. And I think even in our technological age, we can learn those lessons. There are always technological advances. We'll be right back. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with Anything Goes Friday. Your calls, my thoughts, our thoughts, the collective genius of America, right here. Here with you, and the question, why should I care about LIBOR? Well, the city of Baltimore right now is looking at, you know, a serious investigation, seriously looking into the possibility that because they had city funds invested with some of these banks, or they had borrowed money from some of these banks, pension funds are with some of these banks, that all of those things were in this giant betting pool, basically. And the banks were steadily, by manipulating the LIBOR rate, they were steadily siphoning money out of that pool. And Baltimore ends up with less money. And Barclays Bank ends up with more. So the banks have been basically screwing everybody. You know, they've been just incrementally taking little nibbles, you know, off the side of the cookie, right? Every night, just another little nibble. And all the rest of us are left with this, you know, increasingly smaller and smaller chocolate chip cookie. For lack of a better metaphor, right? You know, it's... And the other thing is that all this money is accumulating, is being grabbed by the banksters, which gives them more political power, gives them more influence, gives them more wealth. It's not being used in the productive economy. Now, that may not be such a big deal because money isn't totally a zero-sum game, but it still is an important thing. And then there's the moral argument to be made. Anyhow, Carl in Westfield, Mass., listening to WHMP. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Yes, first-time caller.
Thank you.
I'm going to talk about alternative energy and water fuel and the fact that the converting water into fuel and how it's a technology that no one ever talks about, and I think it is...
Oh, it's called electrolysis.
Right, electrolysis. It's also known as water fuel. There's several different names for it that people use. It has been a technology I've worked for years, and it's...
The problem so far with electrolysis is it takes, you run an electrical current through water, and the cathode nanode, the positive and negative wires or poles or plates or panels or whatever, accumulate hydrogen and oxygen atoms respectively, and those two gases come out and you can extract them. And then later you can throw those gases together in the presence of a spark and they'll burn. And energy is liberated, and you can recover that energy and convert it back into electricity. The problem is that the amount of energy that you put into electrolysis to split, you know, H2O into its H and O components is greater than the amount of energy you get back when you recombine the H and O. I mean, you can't
right.
defy
but
Newton's laws of thermodynamics.
Right, this is true. I've been working on it for actually several years, and I've actually made it more efficient without using an additive like most people do. But also, computers were slow one time, and now computers.
But using water as a storage mechanism for energy, and hydrolysis is a way to extract the energy from it. You know, makes a certain amount of sense. Or using hydrogen as a storage system, but you can't use it as an energy system, as a base, as an originating system. Because you can't surpass 100% efficiency.
That's what a lot of people think, but I would encourage anyone to look up, just type in Stanley Meyer. And
okay.
He ran his car 15 years ago on a dune buggy. He's gone now, but he made major advancements into water technology. He ran vehicles off of just pure water. So it is possible. Just like computers were slow one time, now they're faster. If we invest more into it,
right,
we could use any water to run cars off it.
Okay, well, you know, if somebody can make it happen, Carl, I'm all for it. Jim in Riverside, California. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, you mentioned a few minutes ago that in a science fiction book about the standard value.
Yeah, the SVU, Jack Vance's.
I've been saying that ever since the corporations went international, that they decided that if you could pay people, you know, overseas $3 a day, then why are they paying people, you know, $50 an hour here in America?
Right.
And they're crashing. They're trying to level the playing field.
Oh yeah, absolutely. They're creating a standard value unit for the planet, and I think that, frankly, there should be one for each country. I'm not sure that Jack Vance's system would work. It'd be interesting to get into a conversation with Jack about.
They want to destroy the American economy,
sure,
and bring us down to that third world environment.
It's not just Jim that they want to. They're doing it.
They're doing it.
I mean, they've been doing this for 30 years. It's like, you know, it took us, you know, 50 years to, or 100, 150 years to build this incredible industrial machine, you know, the United States economy that was just hitting its peak in the 1970s. And then Ronald Reagan came along and said, okay, let's take this thing apart and, you know, hand it out to the transnational corporations who, I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan used to be the pitch man for GE Theater, General Electric, Jack Welch, when he was head of GE in his autobiography. You can read it on his website, on his personal website. He brags about how he went to India and came up with the idea of outsourcing white-collar and pink-collar jobs to India. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute. What's wrong with this picture? Ron in Altoona, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Hi, I'm in Altoona, Wisconsin, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
First of all, I wanted to ask what Louise was doing. I've been thinking about her a lot.
Louise is doing well, thank you. She just last week had the third of six chemo treatments. She does one every 3 weeks, so she's a little more than halfway through. And thank you for asking. She's going to be fine.
Well, what you talk about, she sounds like a wonderful woman.
She is.
And anyway, the reason I call is I had a weird kind of question, like I usually do when I call you. I was thinking about it. Now, you and I are about the same age, so we can go back probably to Eisenhower and start remembering political campaigns up to the present now. And this is the first year I really noticed, and, you know, they make promises they can't keep and all that stuff. You expect that. But the Republicans are saying blatant lies that can be proved as blatant lies, such as they said that it's going to cost $2 trillion, or it's the second, one of the biggest tax hikes for Obamacare in the history of the United States.
Right.
Which we both know is crap, and we can prove it.
Yeah.
Since they're making a blatant statement like that, isn't that false advertising? Couldn't a Democratic Party or somebody from Obama sue them?
No, you can't. Ron, you can't sue them, but you can point out that they're lying. And oddly enough, I mean, Romney's running an ad right now as we speak saying that Obama is lying about Romney's record. And, which is pretty amazing to me because the Romney campaign has so many lies at the core of their campaign. So they've gotten really good at doing, whatever. I said this yesterday. I absolutely believe it. Whatever the Romney campaign accuses the Obama campaign of, that's what they're doing. And he wants to be Obama wants to be the outsourcer in chief. Romney said that a couple days ago. Yeah, Romney was the outsourcer in chief. They're going to lie. But the problem, Ron, is that, I'm not even sure it's a problem, is that the Supreme Court has ruled over the years, and I don't disagree with this, that of all the kind of speech that are protected, and it's gotten fairly broad over the years, relatively speaking. I mean, the Supreme Court back in the 70s decided that pornography was a form of speech, free speech, for example, an agreement with which I don't disagree. But I we've expanded the definition of free speech. But of all those things, of all the various ways that free speech can exist, political speech is the most protected. And one man's truth is another man's lies in politics, and there is no ultimate arbiter of that other than the voter. And so we just, we have to stay with that, frankly. I don't see a solution beyond that. Nick in White Bear Lake, Minnesota?
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call.
What's up?
I wanted to talk to you briefly about the voter ID issue.
Sure.
I didn't hear your segment on it earlier this week, but a lot of the common arguments I hear from those who oppose the idea that you should show an ID when you vote is that because it's a constitutional right that it's guaranteed as a citizen of the United States.
No, I don't think anybody's making that argument. There is no constitutional right to vote. In Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court came right out and said it.
Okay, so Why would you be opposed to showing a voter ID, for example?
Because the harm caused by it does not even begin to equal the good created by it.
What harm would that be?
That some 5 to 6 million people who don't have ID wouldn't be able to vote. I'll restate this conversation I had yesterday. I'll do it much more briefly. Basically, we're constantly making risk-benefit analyses of any kind of public policy. Is the cost of this policy is everybody wearing seatbelts, is that going to save enough lives that it's worth the cost and the hassle associated with it? Turns out it does. Okay, so the question is, if we succeed in stopping 100 people every 10 years, 10 or 15 people a year from illegally voting, is the cost to do that, which is throwing 5.5 million people off the voting rolls, is that worth that? Is saving, preventing us from having 100 people illegally vote, is that worth the cost of 5.5 million people not being able to vote? And I submit to you that that's a lousy deal.
Thank you for taking me. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
You're welcome. I mean, it's just very, you know, quite simple. The Republicans, you know, originally the argument was, you know, holy cow, voter fraud, it's a problem. Let's pass really draconian laws. People can go to prison for a long, long period of time if they illegally vote. Well, those laws are all in place now, and nobody's illegally voting. I mean, occasionally you get somebody who kind of blunders into it, but that's about it. So then they had to come along and say, well, really, we just didn't want Democrats to vote. We didn't want people who don't have driver's licenses, who can't afford a car. We don't want them to vote. That's where we are now.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And it's very straightforward. Anyhow, is anything goes Friday, 866-987-THOM. Drop by TomHartman.com, too. You can participate in our free live chat room. Jefferson Memorial. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Victoria Jones on the line with the Talk Radio News Service. This Talk Radio News Service brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on today?
Well, Mitt Romney will be sitting down to tape separate interviews with Fox News, CNN, ABC, NBC, and CBS this afternoon.
Whoa! Now, this is after yesterday he had dinner with Dick Cheney, and they didn't let anybody take pictures of him and Darth Vader together.
That's correct. They didn't let anyone take pictures or video of him with Dick Cheney. Of course, it's also after yesterday's Boston Globe piece, which, even though there'd been a drumbeat, this is the one that, now I'm mixing metaphors, blew the lid off.
Go ahead.
The possible discrepancy between when he says he left Bain Capital and when he might have left Bain Capital,
right,
if it was 1999, and being chairman, CEO, and president of the company, which his campaign is saying now is boilerplate language that you put on forms. That's what they're saying. He is going to have to address this. A question could be asked, how hard will Jonathan Carl, Peter Alexander, Jan Crawford, Carl Cameron, and Jim Acosta press him?
Here's the simple question that I would ask, that frankly I doubt will be asked, but that I would ask. And it just, and maybe it's because I've been, you know, I've been an entrepreneur and I have sold businesses, and in fact, two of the businesses that I sold to my employees. One of them on a 7-year buyout and one on a 1-year buyout. And so I had some interest in making sure that those businesses continued to function. And that simple question is, if you had a business that you owned 100% of and you decided, and it was worth millions of dollars and it represented virtually all of your net worth, and you went off to do charitable work for a year or two, wouldn't you keep an eye on what was going on with that business? It's almost like saying, you know, if you're married to somebody and you got to go out of town, aren't you going to call them every night?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, I think that's a key question. I don't know whether anybody will ask that or whether it'll be asked in that way. But I think it's key because I think we're going to hear some very careful language from his campaign.
What we know is that, you know, in 99 or early 2000, he went off to Salt Lake City from, you know, the Bain is based in Boston. He actually went to Salt Lake City and spent most of his time there to help the Olympics. You know, good on him. Good civic service and all that. But he continued to own 100% of Bain Capital's stock until 2002, maybe 2003.
Right.
As a businessman myself, if I had $100 million, I've never had $100 million in my life, but you know, I've had stock that's worth something in companies that I started. If I had, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars tied up in a company that I had created, that I had birthed, and I turned it over to some people and I went off to do some cool thing for the government and help out my nation, I'd keep track of what was going on.
Well, you're also getting to another core here, which is that a press release has shown up, and Daily Kos has that story through a Nexus search, which issued by Bain Capital and a PR group, I believe it is, at that time, saying that Mr. Romney is on a partial leave of absence.
Partial.
It's either partial, part-time, or half-time, right. Language like that.
Right, which is how I do it.
But the other half is there.
Right, which is how I do it. I mean, if I was going to leave a business, but I still owned it, and, you know, to go off and do some good and noble work, I would check in regularly. You know, I'd want to make sure they weren't killing my business.
Yes, indeed.
And
indeed.
So anyhow, it's going to be very interesting to see how he tries to tap dance around this thing.
It will be extremely interesting to see how that one develops, because they hope that this will put it to rest. I also predict, this is me being psychic,
mm-hmm.
I'm predicting that he will release his 2011 tax returns.
Yeah, he's had enough time now to massage them. In fact, he's probably just gotten around to filing them, because rich guys file late.
Exactly.
But
he won't go further back, which, of course, is what people are interested in.
Well, yeah, and the reason he won't go further back is because probably in 2008 and 2009 he paid no income tax at all.
And that's why the drumbeat, I suspect, won't go away.
Right.
What may save him is either a game changer vice presidential candidate, if that was not a trial Berlin, the London Olympics, which means nobody's going to be interested in him, although he'll be there for a bit, or his foreign trip, which he hopes is going to draw attention to his foreign policy positions.
Right. What he's trying to do right now is frankly what John Kerry should have done early on in the Swift Boat thing, and I don't think this is an appropriate equivalence, because the Swift Boat thing was basically a pack of lies, you know, orchestrated by Jerry Corsi against John Kerry. But what he should have done was shut that thing down as hard and as fast as he could. And that's what Romney's trying to do right now. Problem is that I don't think that Romney can successfully say, I don't think anybody's going to believe him if he says, yes, I left my business that was worth hundreds of millions of dollars and that represented all of my net worth and my entire future. I left it in the hands of people, you know, of 29 people, and I let them run it, and I had no idea what was going on. I don't think anybody's going to believe that.
I think it's going to be very hard for people to believe that, particularly as there seems to be evidence coming out of participation in conference calls.
Well, and not only participation, he was on the board of directors of one of the companies that they'd invested in right up until 2003.
And in his federal disclosure form, filed as part of his presidential bid, he said, since February 11, 1999, Romney has not had any active role with any Bain Capital entity and has not been involved in the operations of any Bain Capital entity in any way.
So if that is not true, that's a felony, a federal felony.
You're going to get told off by the Romney campaign like Stephanie Cutter from the Obama campaign did yesterday for suggesting that.
Well, if it's not true, it's a federal felony. That's a statement of fact. The question is whether it's not true, right?
Well, that's what she said. She said it, but she was still told off.
Yeah. Well, I would expect them to tell me off, too. Wear it as a badge of honor. Victoria Jones, thank you.
Thank you.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, which is brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. Learn more online at germany.info. Back with, we've got some great LIBOR calls here, and more right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Excuse me here while I close a couple of windows. Chat room throwing windows at me. Please don't do that. 866-97-THOM. LIBOR. Ray. Hey, Ray in Riverside, California. You have a LIBOR metaphor?
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, there are at least four kinds of activities that can bring somebody to court for racketeering.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Number one, just very general financial institution fraud.
Right.
Number two, fraud in sale of securities. I mean, these interest rates that they're fixing, of course, affects the securities they're selling.
Right.
There is number three, embezzlement from pensions. People's pensions have disappeared in these financial transactions.
Right.
And finally, my favorite, which may not be related, but transmission of gambling information.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Is this from the RICO laws that you're quoting this?
I'm sorry?
Is this from the RICO, the racketeering, corrupt organizations and racketeering, or the RICO laws, or is this some other racketeering law? What's the source of this information?
RICO laws.
These are the RICO laws. Very interesting.
I just looked it up. If you just look up racketeering, one of the definitions that comes up on Google takes you to this page that explains that under federal laws, you know, at least there's a huge number of activities, but I just picked up very quickly these four that I think apply. So they could be charged for racketeering. Very simple.
Yeah. Remarkable. Ray, and we'll see how this plays out. Thank you for the call. Robert in Ironwood, Michigan. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Tom, I just wanted to say that I heard about this LIBOR, and I checked some of my files where, I three houses since 88, and several different mortgages on each one.
Right.
And about 1996, they started quoting LIBOR rates.
So your mortgages were tied to the LIBOR rates?
So one of them was, and I have a couple other offers in my files, okay, that were tied to the LIBOR rates that we didn't accept.
Right. So if LIBOR was being jiggered so that...
That was 1996 when the LIBOR started being listed on these forms.
Right. And if that was being manipulated in a way that ended up helping the banks, it hurt you.
Right.
So,
the other thing I wanted to say.
Interesting. Yeah.
They're talking about Condoleezza Rice being his VP.
Yeah, I don't think it's
going to
happen.
You know what I think? She's going to be because she's a better liar than he is. She can lie a lot better with a straight face and smiling at you.
She has done that successfully in the past, but he's very, very good at it. That would be a tough competition. Robert, thank you for the call. Albert in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Albert, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Love your show and all that you do.
Thank you.
I've got a great LIBOR analogy that I think Americans will understand.
Okay.
The banks are casinos or other sports betting organizations,
right,
and the rates are the game officials. And the casinos own the officials, and they and their friends make their bets knowing that the officials are going to make the games come out just the way they want it.
Right. So it's sort of like what Shane's suggestion, which was that, you know, you're playing Texas Hold'em, but you know what the down card is, or you know what the other person's cards are, or, you know, or the whole card, is that what it's called? It's been
yep,
a lot of years
yep,
since
and
I played
it'll
Texas
be
Hold'em.
Interesting to see just how this translate to America too, because right now it's a lot over in England and not in America, but I'm sure it's gonna, you know, come back to haunt a lot of the banks here too.
I count on it. This is the scary thing is that, as Bernie Sanders pointed out, six banks hold $9 trillion worth of assets. That's two-thirds of the entire GDP of the United States, and if those six banks go down, we are really toast. Thank you very much for the call, Albert. Sean in Cincinnati. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Hey, Tom, love your show, man. Listen, I just wanted to let you know, I think we're going to find out that Romney's both a liar and a felon. I don't know if you're aware, but Huffington Post just broke a story where they now have documented proof of his signature on at least six different documents pertaining to acquisitions that Bain Capital made from 99 to 2002.
Oh, really? Now this is what I was saying. In fact, there it is. I just pulled up Huffington Post, poison pen. Romney at work during retirement. This just makes common sense. I mean, as a business person myself, you know, I haven't built a business as successful as you know, hundreds of millions as Romney did. But my business has actually generally made things and did things for people,
right,
rather than buying and selling businesses. But if I had all of my wealth, all of my future, all of my, you know, blood, sweat, and tears tied up in my one business that I had built in my life, and I went off to do something for my country for a couple of years, and it wasn't like joining the military. I mean, when he went off to Salt Lake City, he could hop on the guy's got a private plane. He could come home on the weekends. He could come home every Thursday. He could spend every third week back in, you know, it's like, this is not rocket science. You look over your assets. You look out for what's going on. So,
absolutely. I'm a former business owner myself, and I just knew from day one that something it wasn't right. And, to see something like this come out, it's just beautiful. I haven't stopped laughing since I read it.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, thanks a lot, Sean. Appreciate it. Pete in Chicago. Hey, Pete, what's up?
Hey, how are you? I got a financial thing for you, but first I want to tell you, your show actually works. I'm one of those that used to be a staunch right-wing conservative that has seen the light, and I'm like 90% over on your side now. So.
Wow. Well, thank you.
It does bear fruit.
Thank you.
But the reason I called is yesterday morning on the Financial News Network on television, they had an interview with Warren Buffett, former Senator Simpson from Wyoming,
right,
and Erskine Bowles.
Right.
I don't know if you caught that or not.
I didn't.
But they were talking about the precarious situation. And what shocked me was that they asked Mr. Bowles if he thought we could still avoid going over the precipice.
Right.
And he said, considering the seriousness and the magnitude of our financial difficulties and the probability that Congress is incapable of doing anything to prevent it, he says, as far as he's concerned, it's a done deal. We're going over the edge. There's no stopping it anymore.
Yeah. I agree.
Even more shocking.
I agree with that
Bowles
analysis.
Buffett and Simpson concurred. This is shocking news.
Yeah.
Why isn't it on headline news?
It's a very good question, especially if Warren Buffett. You know, Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles have been, their credibility got sidelined when they couldn't come out with a single consensus report from their committee. You know, and so they came up with their own report, which was not the official legal report. Everybody refers to it as if it was, but
right.
It wasn't. But Warren Buffett has considerable credibility. You know, he's doing very well. Thank you very much. And he makes his money betting on which way the market's going to go and where companies are going to go. And it would be really, really interesting to look into the Berkshire Hathaway balance sheet and find out how liquid he's getting, how much he's converting into cash.
The thing is with Warren Buffett, the companies he owns, for the most part, he owns them outright. He can ride out any storm.
Right.
He hasn't gone out and borrowed 90% of the money to buy these things. You know what I mean?
Right.
So even if we do go over the edge, companies he owns are all going to survive. They may have tough times. They may not make as much profit. Buffett's going to survive.
Yeah,
and
yeah, and you may see Hathaway stock, you know, drop from $10,000 a share to $8,000 a share, but it'll come back eventually.
But the shocking thing is that if we're on the edge of the precipice, and the consensus of people of that stature is that there's no saving us anymore.
Yeah.
My God, that should be ringing bells all over the place.
Yeah. Well, I've been singing this song for a couple of years here. I predicted the crash before it happened. And since the crash, I've been saying this is not the end. We are in a bubble. We are not in a recovery. And because the fundamentals have not been changed. And we need...
Scary. Whoever the next president is, whoever wins, I'm telling you, I think the next 4 years are going to be a disaster.
They're going to be very interesting because I think that as bad as it's going to get, it's also going to be the salvation of this country. Because when it gets that bad, that's the point at which the American people are going to wake up and say, whoa, wait a minute, this Reaganomics stuff is not working. Just like they woke up in the 30s out of Coolidge-nomics in the 20s.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Hoover-nomics and Harding-nomics. Actually, Warren Harding started it in the election of 1920 with his slogan, his election slogan, more business in government, less government in business. There you go, Friday the 13th. Welcome back. And it's amazing. It's just amazing. Poor Mitt Romney. He's going to do interviews with everybody today in hoping that he's going to just put this thing to bed. We'll see. Patty in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Patty, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good. How you doing?
Sorry, I had a speakerphone there for a second. I apologize about that.
It's quite all right. Are you there?
Are you still there, Tom?
Yes.
Hello?
Okay. Yes, you're on the air.
I had a question about LIBOR. I read in Firedog-like, and I don't know how dependable this is, that the rates that municipalities were paying to bondholders was a rate of, like, basically auction securities rates, which were not at all tied to LIBOR. So when the blank hit the fan back in 2008, and regular market rates went through the roof, LIBOR essentially was fixed to stay low.
Mm-hmm.
So these municipalities, in effect, didn't even have a fixed rate of interest since the interest that they were receiving from Barclays is based on a artificially suppressed index.
That's right. They were
having to pay out to. Okay, sorry.
No, you're right. They were artificially pushing it down. Yes.
Right. You know, I guess the point is that even if they were artificially pushing it down, they still thought they were in a fixed rate, right?
Right.
Because as long as the auction rates are tied to LIBOR, then they should be in a fixed rate.
But here's the problem. During that period of time, those municipalities could not borrow at that rate. There was no money available.
Right.
Nobody was lending. So it was a phony baloney rate.
Yes. Yes. And I just, the only place I've read that it's actually made that point is Fire Dog Lake. Everybody else kind of puts it in the narrative that, hey, they entered into a fixed rate when the rates were high, and then got screwed because rates actually went lower.
Right.
And in fact, they didn't even get a fixed rate. They end up having the worst of both worlds.
Right. The municipalities. This is the argument that the city of Baltimore is making right now, and making it very aggressively. And, we'll see. I mean, they're looking to demonstrate that they have been harmed by this. And I think if they can, and we had a caller earlier pointing out that this falls right smack dab in the crosshairs of the RICO laws, of the racketeering laws. And we'll see where this goes. But, Patty, my thought on that was that because the markets were frozen, because there was no money available, had LIBOR actually reflected the actual risk of lending and the actual availability, the actual cost of money, then there would have been money available. And the markets might not have frozen up if LIBOR wasn't being manipulated, if that makes any sense. I think it, makes sense to me.
If
Baltimore's is needing money, and the bank is saying, we're committed to lend to you at the LIBOR rate, and the LIBOR rate is 2.5%, but right now the money has become precious, right? It's hard to get money. Well, when it's hard to get money, the value of money goes up. That means interest rates go up. So the city might be willing to pay 3 or 4 or 5%, and the bank actually might loan a 3 or 4 or 5%. During a tough time, because there's a risk reward ratio here, which LIBOR is supposed to reflect. But if LIBOR is artificially low, the bank is looking at that going, I'm not going to loan at that rate. And the city's going, we can't borrow at this rate. And then they're really screwed. And then you get this freezing up of the markets.
Yeah.
I'm speculating about this. I don't have actual evidence of this. This is just, just running logic here.
Well, I'm saying I don't know exactly all the logic, because it doesn't matter what they stay the LIBOR at, nobody was going to lend money after Lehman Brothers fell, because there was just a serious question of the liquidity of all the counterparties, right?
Well, no, not necessarily. Not necessarily. I mean, there were plenty of very liquid counterparties out there, including municipalities and including some very large corporations. And I mean, there was a lot of concern about financial institutions after Lehman fell.
Okay.
But I don't think that there was any serious doubt that ExxonMobil was going to run out of money, or that Apple was going to run out of cash.
Well, you think that is assuming they have all this cash in the vault somewhere on.
Well, they do. I mean, you've got, transnationals based in the United States right now sitting on $2 trillion in the U.S.
They hold it in a bank, though. And that bank's already, the bank has it basically, they lend it most of it out. I mean, they only keep 10, 20% in reserve.
That's a lot less than that these days.
So ExxonMobil's liquidity is based on whatever the depository institution's liquidity is. And if the depository institution's liquidity, if they have deposited Bank of America, who's illiquid, then ExxonMobil's illiquid as well.
Right.
So I'm not sure. I think there was some, I think once,
The question at the core of all of this is, well, how did I get hurt, right? How did you and I get hurt? How did Baltimore get hurt? If it's just, the big boys making some money and scamming each other, most people would just shrug their shoulders. if, you know, and, you know, yeah, let them get prosecuted. You know, it's sort of like, you know, was Martha Stewart trading on inside information? And that wasn't actually what she was even prosecuted for. It was lying about it. But, you know, it's that kind of thing. It doesn't affect me. But, you know, if there's an actual harm to us, then it does affect us. And there are a number of municipalities and a number of pension funds that are asserting that there was a harm, a very specific harm to them, that had to do with liquidity in the marketplace and the rates that were being paid and their ability to get financing and to continue operations, that had to do with LIBOR being rigged. And you and I both need to, we need to learn a lot more about this. All of us need to learn a lot more about this as this kind of thing unravels.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Whoever thought we'd be sitting around talking about LIBOR? I mean, it's just incredible. Oh, yeah, there's the Dalai Lama. It's a really cool movie about that time, that week that we spent with His Holiness in Dharamsala. It's called Dalai Lama Renaissance, narrated by Harrison Ford. And I'm in it. It's a hoot. Anyhow, welcome back. It's Anything Goes Friday, 34 minutes past the hour. Mitt Romney in a world of trouble, it looks like. And it's going to be real interesting to see how he wriggles out of this one. Because they're just, you know, over at Huffington Post, their top story, they Bain comment, Romney comment, this is a lie, here's the proof, here's the signature, that's a lie, here's the proof, here's the signature. And Romney's booked all these interviews with all this media for tonight, according to Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. And, you have to wonder, is he trying to wriggle out of being nailed? Is he a felon? Did he actually lie on FEC forms? Is he going to announce that he's going to turn his presidential campaign over to Herman Cain? Who would it be? I mean, think about it for a minute. If Romney actually is a felon and it's come out that he's a felon because he lied to the Federal Election Commission, or the Securities and Exchange Commission, one or the other, FEC or SEC. If it turns out that he's a felon, is he going to have to recuse himself to, you know, I don't know if that's maybe not the right phrase, but, you know, pull out and say, you know, okay, I'm not running for president anymore. So who do the Republicans have? Oh, they go to Ricky Santorum. He was the last man standing, right? Or was it Newt? No, it was Santorum. Newt dropped out before Santorum, didn't he? I'm not sure. It might be that Newt was the last. Who was the last man standing? Shano's on it. Somebody in the chat room probably knows. Shane doesn't remember. Jim doesn't remember. Paul doesn't remember. This is how memorable it was, right? I mean, they were all dropping like flies there. But I'm pretty sure Herman Cain dropped out a little earlier than that. But who is he going to hand it over to? I don't know. Hey, Mark Taylor Canfield's on the line with Occupy Seattle. What's going on with the Occupy movement these days, Mark?
Hey, Tom, it's good to talk to you. I just wanted to make sure that people realize that there was a document that was delivered yesterday after a 100-mile march from Philadelphia where the Occupy National Gathering was held.
Mm-hmm.
And those activists from Occupy Wall Street marched to Wall Street and delivered what they're calling a vision for a new democratic future. And this document is available at the OccupyNationalGathering.com website.
Okay.
Anybody can go there and read it. And basically, it's the document that came out of all of the visioning process for the Occupy National Conference. And it's available for anybody to read. And it directly addresses all of the grievances that we have as a movement and also some of the reform measures that we're calling for.
That's great.
Sounds like
this generation's Port Huron statement.
Yeah, I also introduced a more specific document, which is a Declaration of Independence from Wall Street. So it specifically targets Wall Street, talks about the need for a dissolution between the political relationship between our government and Wall Street in terms of dominating our elections and our governmental decisions. So we as the people, we as the government, would like to protect our government from the corporate influence, which has been taking us down the wrong path right now.
Right.
So glad to send you that document, and I would love your feedback on that, with a lot of creds to Tom Jefferson for writing the original, because it's basically based on that.
Sounds like a plan.
People know that we have an Occupy National Gathering document that is available at OccupyNationalGathering.com that anybody can look at, and it'll give you an idea of what people were thinking at the conference and where we're going from here. So I just wanted to help get that information out, Tom.
Mark,
thank you.
You did a great job. Thank you very much, and thanks for the call. Paul in Detroit. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
Yeah, I just like a couple callers back, I just first want to point out that I, too, am a recovering Republican, and I feel so much better now that I'm not drinking their poison Kool-Aid anymore.
Yeah, well, good on you.
Yeah, I have an analogy for the LIBOR rate. It kind of goes along with your casino analogy.
Okay.
Would it be like a casino being able to control the next spin on a roulette wheel,
mm-hmm.
or being able to deal themselves a blackjack anytime they feel like it? Like when they see a whole lot of people have a whole lot of money on the table, right then they deal themselves a blackjack and take it all, since they're controlling the interest rate. You know?
Right, right. But they're also the thing that is, you know, pre. Gramm-Leach-Bliley, you know, back when there was still the Glass-Steagall Act, when the banks that set the interest rates were different than the investment banks. You know, you had commercial banks and investment banks, and you had these two separate kinds of banks. The banks couldn't be parties to the gambling. Now that this has all been blown up, both here and in the UK, the banks can be parties to the gambling. And so it's to extend that a little bit, it would be like the house is going to rig the roulette wheel to stop on 10, you know,
right.
or stop on black or whatever. And there are five people of the 20 people at the roulette table, five of them work for the house, and they're betting large amounts of money on 10.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So, I mean, even taking it to the next step. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Okay, great. That was a good start. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Since this is Everything Goes Friday, I wanted to compare our democracy with French democracy. We both had revolutions, and because it's Bastille Day tomorrow.
Oh, it is.
And I think that, you know, if on a scale of 1 to 10, we're about 0.5 right now, and I don't know how we got there, but that's a fact.
I can tell you how we got there, very simply.
Because they have more democratic, they have more parties, they take care of their people, they have a great pension plan, they retire earlier, all of these kinds of things, of which you do say yourself.
Sure. I can tell you how we got here. It's real simple. We got here by virtue of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court started it. I mean, arguably it began in 1815 in the Dartmouth case when they recognized that a corporation had standing before the Supreme Court. But then it went even beyond that. In 1886, in the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad case, the Supreme Court did not rule that corporations are people, but the clerk of the court, John Chandler Bancroft Davis, wrote it into the headnote, which had no legal authority, that corporations are people. Then over the next 30 or 40 years, there were half a dozen cases where the Supreme Court referenced that headnote, and then that became the precedent of corporations becoming people. And, you know, based on the 14th Amendment, which was passed in 1870-something, thereabouts, 1868, I think. And then, you know, it kind of went to sleep during most of the early 20th century until 1973, when Richard Nixon put Lewis Powell on the Supreme Court. And Lewis Powell was the guy who wrote the memo to his next-door neighbor and best friend, who was the president of the Chamber of Commerce, saying, you know, we're under assault. And they were looking at people like Ralph Nader, who had just published Unsafe at Any Speed, and Rachel Carson, who had published Silent Spring. And he said, you know, corporations are under assault in America. We've got to fight back. We've got to build an infrastructure. We need an intellectual infrastructure. We need think tanks. We need to be getting into colleges. We need to control politics. You know, the corporations need to get involved. And then just a few months after he wrote that memo which was the incarnating event, that memo, the Powell memo. You can Google it online and read it. And that event, that brought about the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, all, you know, just on and on, the whole list goes. And then once that was done, then Powell got put on the Supreme Court. And in the 70s and 80s, Lewis Powell was leading these decisions were leading the court to these decisions like Buckley versus Vallejo and First National Bank versus Ablotti, where in Buckley they said money is actually speech, and in First National Bank they said that corporations have the right to participate in politics. And then, of course, that leads us to Citizens United, which brought it all together, put a nice big bow on it. But,
that
did not happen in France.
I'd like to be able to say just one more thing as far as,
when
you compare, one democracy to another, and you see that one democracy has fared better and they actually have broke with an aristocracy, then look at what they do and how their government is structured. Then maybe that's what we should do too. I mean, all of these legal history is nice, but there is a fundamental flaw with our democracy,
yes.
And I'm rather tired of it. I wish I paid attention in French class and moved years ago when I had the opportunity to do it, because I'm frankly damn tired of the whole damn thing.
Well, then get involved. Help us take it back.
Let me tell you something.
Tomorrow's Bastille Day, we need to storm the Bastille.
Billionaires who basically, they don't play by the rules. They basically make the law themselves.
Yep.
They scam the whole system in their favor.
Yep.
And until there is a fundamental, break in this whole country, and we end up in a revolutionary type of thing, which I don't really want to see. I've known people that have lived through the Russian Revolution. It's not any picnic.
No, revolutions are always horrible things, as our civil wars, as we saw here.
Thing that they
but,
want.
Yeah, I had dinner last night with David Cobb, the guy who founded Move to Amend, or co-founded it, and movetoamend.org. And they are growing like a weed. There are chapters springing up all over the country. They've gotten more than 300 communities now, including several states, to pass resolutions saying that we need to amend the Constitution to say that corporations aren't people and money isn't speech. We need to go back to first principles. We need to undo this corruption that I chronicled through all the legal history there a few minutes ago. We need to undo this, and there's a simple way to do it, and that's to amend the Constitution. We have done that before, back during the Vietnam War or after the Vietnam War or toward the tail end of it, when everybody said, hey, it's crazy that we're sending kids off to kill and die, but they can't vote on whether or not we should have a law. We dropped the voting age from 21 to 18. That law was introduced in March, as I recall, and became law in August. I may be off on my months, but I know it was less than a third of a year. From beginning to end, to amend the Constitution, we can do it again.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the way to do it again is to go to movetoamend.org and sign up. Do it now. We'll be back.
I see trees of green. Red roses too, I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producer, Shane Farnan, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screeners, Paul Edney and Rain Koch, to writer-researcher Paul Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager Ron Hartenbaum, everybody at our syndicators, Dow Global, Pacifica Radio, Free Speech TV, Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers that carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones, and all the great folks at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for our tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Seriously, thank you. Michael in Dublin, Ohio. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
This is Michael in Dublin, Virginia.
Virginia, my apologies. Hey, Michael, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, look, psychologically there's a chemical called THC that affects us, that affects our brain.
Yeah, tetrahydrocannabinol.
Yes, and then what happened on the 1st of July is the president signed the Food and Drug Administration. It's called the Food and Drug Administration Safety and Innovation Act.
Right.
That bans any chemical that's considered a receptor of the H1 and H2 receptors in the brain. So that means they
really?
Can't,
So any chemical that affects the brain the same way the THC, we should say for our listeners who don't know what we're talking about, is the active ingredient of pot, of marijuana. That any chemical that stimulates the brain the same way pot does, you know, through the same neurochemical pathways, is now a criminal.
Yes, yes. And the thing is the H1 and H2, or some people say the R1 and H2 receptors.
Right.
So what this does is this part of the brain is an active awareness. It creates an active awareness when triggered as to your surroundings.
Right.
They ban this chemical that's naturally in our body, that cannabinoid.
Right.
It's a chemical structure. So this is now banned. So we have people who slip through the cracks, who the only way they can become aware of what's going on is through the cannabinoid activation. But they ban any chemical that stimulates that.
Wow. The H1, H2, those are histamine receptors that you're talking about, aren't you? Or what am I missing here?
Well, it's also described as R1 and R2 receptors. It's okay. A part of the brain. I wouldn't say histamine receptors. Histamine would have to do with, it could be a cellular structure that actually is used to trigger something. In this case, you're talking about histamine. Yeah. You're talking
well, these would
about,
be cannabinoid receptors, really, ultimately,
exactly.
whatever they're called.
They
yeah,
right.
Michael, I'm going to move along, but thank you for the heads up on that. I did not know, and that, you know, I'm sure it was a well-intentioned effort to say, okay, if somebody's going to try and come up with synthetic pot, we're going to have the right to regulate it, but, you know, come on, guys. Frank in Bronx, New York. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I'd like to talk about the poorest part of the world, sub-Sahara Africa. I know you've been to Africa a few times yourself.
I have.
Tom,
we've done this show from there, in fact. We did the show 3 years ago for a week from South Sudan, right on the border with Darfur, from a town called Gok Machar.
Oh, wow. Tom, does it bother you that the worst crime in the history of human beings, and when I say worst crime, I mean as in total of numbers, is not even taught in school or in college? And I'm referring to the Scramble of Africa. I'm sure you know what that is.
Oh, yeah.
When you have all the European nations in 1880 during the Industrial Revolution going into Europe.
Going into Africa.
Yeah. And killing millions of people. I'm sure people
have ever read King Leopold's Ghost?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly, King Leopold the Belgian and all that.
Yep.
And, you know, turning 25,000 tribes into 40 countries, and just the resources that are in Africa. I mean, Africans should be the richest people in the world, and there's all these Chinese corporations and American corporations and European
British
corporations.
British and French and Italian and Belgian and Dutch and, yeah. Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
you know, look.
What did you notice when you were in Africa? Anything that relates to the Scramble for Africa?
Not so much, but I wasn't in those areas. I mean, when I was there in the 70s and 80s, I was in Uganda and in Kenya in famine regions and war regions. And so I was seeing people, you know, starving to death. And when I was in Sudan a couple of years ago with Ellen Ratner, we were in a refugee camp. It was a little town of 7,000 people. We were 500 miles from the nearest electricity or paved road, came in by you know, flew in a cargo plane, brought a bunch of tons of food in with us, and we did the show by satellite phone, you know, just brought our own batteries. And there was one hand-pumped well for the 7,000 people in this town, and they had 45,000 refugees who had fled over the border from Darfur. And when we were flying out, you could see this village being burned in Darfur by the Bashir government, by the North Sudan. It was horrible. But, you know, we spent a couple of hours with Salva Kiir, the president of South Sudan, which had just, you know, he had been one of the leaders of this horrible, bloody civil war, and you know, they were victorious. And he was talking about how the Norwegians were metering the oil, the Chinese were buying it, and, you know, it was a mess. And you're right, you know, the resource and the conflict right now between Sudan and South Sudan has everything to do with where the oil is and who gets the oil and where it's going. So, yeah, the other big resource battle other than oil, and that's been going on also in Nigeria for forever, you know, with Shell Oil and Ken Sawahiro, that's not his name, but it's close to that, is the rare earth metals, you know, the things that are used to make semiconductors. But, Frank, you put your finger on something really important. We should do a program about it again. It's been a while since we have. Thank you for the call. Coming up Monday on the Tom Harbin program, we'll have the latest on the Senate's upcoming vote on the Disclose Act and what Mitt Romney had to say, plus socialist Europe. How about socialist America? We're going to debate conservative radio host Chris Markowski and the best of the rest of the news and your calls. Don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Go to movetoamend.org. Get out there. Occupy something. Tag your it. We'll see you tomorrow. Or see you Monday, actually.
You've been listening to Tom Hartmann. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartmann.com.